Welcome to Reader's Digest, brought to you by OWL Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest. First, an article of national interest. They are less expensive than hospitals, but when a facility isn't equipped to handle an emergency, the consequences can be deadly. Here's "Are Surgery Centers Safe?" by Christina Jewett and Mark Alesia from the Kaiser Health News and USA Today Network in Reader's Digest. The surgery went fine. Her doctors left for the day. 4 hours later, Paulina Tom started gasping for air. Internal bleeding was cutting off her windpipe, a well-known complication of the spine surgery she had undergone. But a Medicare inspection report says that nobody who remained on duty that evening at the Northern California Surgery Center could help. In desperation, a nurse did something that would not happen in a hospital. She dialed 911. By the time an ambulance delivered Tom to the emergency room, the 58-year-old mother of three was lifeless, according to the report. If Tom had been operated on at a hospital, a few simple steps could have saved her life. But like hundreds of thousands of patients each year, Tom went to one of the nation's 5,600-plus surgery centers. Surgery centers were created nearly 50 years ago as low-cost alternatives to minor procedures. They now outnumber hospitals as federal regulators have signed off on an ever-widening array of outpatient surgeries in an effort to cut federal health care costs. Thousands of times each year, these centers call 911 when patients experience complications ranging from minor to fatal. Yet no one knows how many people die as a result of those complications because no national authority tracks the tragic outcomes. An investigation by Kaiser Health News and the USA Today Network in March 2018 discovered that more than 260 patients have died since the year 2013 after in-and-out procedures done at surgery centers across the country. Dozens of people, some as young as 2 years old, have perished after routine procedures such as tonsillectomies and colonoscopies. The investigation, which involved examinations of more than 12,000 state and Medicare inspection records and interviews with dozens of doctors, health policy experts, and patients, revealed some startling trends. Chief among them? At least 14 patients of the more than 260, counting Tom, died after complex spinal surgeries. At least 25 people with a variety of underlying medical conditions left surgery centers and died within minutes or days. They included an Ohio woman with out-of-control blood pressure, a 49-year-old West Virginia man awaiting a heart transplant, and several children with sleep apnea. Medicare does require surgery centers to line up a local hospital to take their patients when emergencies arise, but in rural areas, centers can be more than 20 miles away from a hospital. Even when one is close, 20 to 30 minutes can pass between a 911 call and arrival at an ER. Surgery carries risk no matter where it occurs, and most operations done in surgery centers go off without a hitch. Some centers have state-of-the-art equipment and highly trained staff that are better prepared to handle emergencies. But the Kaiser USA Today study found more than a dozen cases in which the absence of trained staff or emergency equipment appears to have put spine surgery patients in peril. And in cases similar to Tom's, patients who had surgery on their upper spines have been sent home too soon, with the risk of suffocation looming. In the year 2008, a 35-year-old Oregon father of three struggled for air, pounding the car roof in frustration while his wife sped him to the hospital. Another Oregon man began to suffocate in his living room the night of his upper spine surgery in the year 2014. A San Diego man gasped, quote-unquote, like a fish, his wife recalled, as they waited for an ambulance on April 28, 2016. None of them survived. Many in the healthcare field, from doctors to private insurance companies to Medicare, have dismissed the mounting deaths as medical anomalies beyond the control of physicians. Responding to lawsuits around the nation, surgery centers have argued that fatal complications were among the known outcomes of such surgeries. Two centers blamed patients for negligence in their own demises. Bill Prentice, chief executive officer of the Ambulatory Surgery Center Association, said he has seen no data proving surgery centers are less safe than hospitals. The human body is a mysterious thing, and a patient that has met every possible protocol can walk in that day and still have something unimaginable happen to them that has nothing to do with the care that's being provided, he said. However, Kenneth Rothfield, MD, a board member of the Physician-Patient Alliance for Health and Safety, said many surgery centers and physicians push the envelope on how much can be done in outpatient centers. Surgery centers are not hospitals, he said. They have different resources, different equipment. Rebecca Shaw, 67 years old, had gone to Oak Tree Surgery in Edison, New Jersey, for a simple colonoscopy. After receiving the standard anesthetic, she stopped breathing. The anesthesiologist, Yuri Yim, MD, later testified that she came up empty-handed when she tried to find the right-sized airway tube for Shaw, according to an ongoing lawsuit. Dr. Yim tried a variety of methods to help Shaw breathe, with limited success. Paramedics responding to the center's 911 call ultimately had to use a video glide scope, equipment the surgery center didn't have, to see inside Shaw's throat, according to court testimony. What's more, paramedics testified that Dr. Yim refused to move away from Shaw and allow them to attempt life-saving measures. An expert for the surgery center said Shaw's airway was obstructed and was cleared around the time the paramedics arrived. He said the glide scope was not required in New Jersey, nor would it have likely made a difference. Shaw's family has settled its lawsuit against the center, which denied wrongdoing, under confidential terms. An expert for Dr. Yim, however, said that her actions were appropriate and if a glide scope had been at the center, quote, we would probably not be discussing this case at all, unquote. Instead, from the moment Shaw stopped breathing on the operating table, 33 minutes passed before a paramedic effectively inserted a breathing tube, according to medical and EMS records. By then, the family claims it was too late. Shaw was removed from life support at a nearby hospital 2 days later. She died on Christmas Day, 2015. The explosive growth of surgery centers, which receive $4.3 billion a year from Medicare, has taken place under circumstances some medical experts consider unseemly. Federal law allows surgery center doctors, unlike others, to steer patients to facilities they own rather than to the full-service hospital down the street. In some cases, doing so could increase the risk to a patient, but double a physician's profits. Doctors who own a share of a center can earn their own fee plus a cut of the facility's fee, a meaningful sum for operations that can cost $100,000 or more. Prentice said physician ownership of surgery centers is a good thing. The physicians who practice there are responsible for everything that happens in that surgery center, from the moment the patient walks out of their car in the parking lot to the moment they leave, he said. But several studies have shown that surgery center doctors who are owners perform operations more frequently than those who aren't owners. And in lawsuits across the country, surgery center doctors have been accused of taking risks with patients. Larry Tuber, MD, a South Dakota neurosurgeon who worked as an executive in the surgery center industry for 22 years, said he has watched surgery center owners take on increasingly complex and lucrative orthopedic and spinal surgeries, undercutting a nearby hospital's profits for their own gain. The money overshadows everything, Dr. Tuber says. The first surgery center in the United States opened in Phoenix in the year 1970. In 1982, Medicare began paying for procedures at these centers, which helped drive their expansion. Today, there are more than 5,600 Medicare-certified centers. The expansion has come despite lingering safety concerns. In the year 2007, Medicare noted that surgery centers have neither patient safety standards consistent with those in place for hospitals, nor are they required to have the trained staff and equipment needed to provide the breadth and intensity of care. Some procedures are, quote-unquote, unsafe to be handled at surgery centers, the report concluded. While the thrum of a hospital continues through the night, some centers' doctors keep banker's hours. That means patients whose surgeries end later in the day are sometimes left in the care of one or two nurses for up to 23 hours. Medicare advised the centers to transfer patients to hospital when emergencies arise. Only a third of surgery centers, though, participate in a voluntary effort to report how often that happens. They sent at least 7,000 patients to the hospital in the year that ended in September 2017, a Kaiser Health News analysis shows. One of the saddest cases reviewed in the investigation happened in the year 2016 at West Lakes Surgery Center in Iowa. The paramedics arrived as staff tried to revive 12-year-old Ruben Van Veldhuizen after he experienced complications during a tonsillectomy, according to a Medicare inspection report. One paramedic told state inspectors she had to ask who was in charge of the resuscitation efforts. No one replied, the report says. The boy made it to the hospital 37 minutes after the surgery center staff called 911. There, he was pronounced dead. The family filed suit, alleging that the center and anesthesiologist erred in giving the boy an anesthetic that carries a warning about cardiac arrest risk in young boys. In court filings, the surgery center and anesthesiologist said Van Veldhuizen's death was a result of, quote, pre-existing conditions, acts of others, or conditions over which defendants had no control or responsibility, unquote. Such tragedies rarely find their way into the discussion when Medicare decides whether to approve new procedures at surgery centers. For example, until the year 2015, Medicare wouldn't pay for spinal operations at surgery centers. Then the industry's trade association urged the agency to make a change and encouraged its members to start a campaign. Letter writers included Alan Villavicencio, M.D., who said he'd been doing such surgeries for 12 years and found that his patients, quote-unquote, appreciate the convenience and cost savings. He did not mention that James Long, 56 years old, had died 3 weeks earlier after spinal surgery at a Lafayette, Colorado surgery center where he is an owner, health department and medical board records show. United Surgical Partners International, a surgery center chain, urged the approval of even more procedures, not mentioning a patient death hours after a spine surgery at one of its affiliate centers several months before, according to court records and securities filings. The chain said in a statement that it stands behind its comments in support of the proposal. Such letters carry weight with Medicare, which approves procedures in surgery centers based on the invasiveness and complexity of the surgery and on input from stakeholders. But Robert Beatty Walters, an attorney based in Portland, Oregon, who has represented the families of three people who died after spine procedures at surgery centers, said Medicare's decision-making process is not even-handed. The stakeholders, they call them, during these regulatory proceedings are the profit makers, not the people who are being provided the service, he said. Medicare approved 10 spine surgery procedures to be billed at surgery centers starting in the year 2015 and added more in 2017. In an email, a spokesperson for Medicare said that it had received no comments suggesting the procedures would pose a threat to patients. And yet, in the year 2014, Paulina Tom had died after a spinal procedure at Fremont Surgery Center. Tom had finished careers as a nurse and as an educator and planned to travel the world with her husband of 32 years. She was the driving force of the family, the spirit, said her son, Eric Tom, M.D. of New York City. We didn't expect the worst to happen. Pain from a car crash had bothered Tom for years. Her doctor scheduled her for a procedure to replace two discs in her upper spine on April 7, 2014. Any such surgery, entering the front of the neck to address pain in the spine, comes with a risk of suffocation, according to the Medicare inspection report. About 4 hours after her procedure, Tom told a nurse that her surgical collar felt too tight. Then she said she couldn't breathe. With her surgeon and anesthesiologist already gone for the day, the only doctor on site was a digestive health specialist, the inspection report shows. A nurse called a code blue just after 6:30 p.m., records say. Medical experts say the first step in helping such patients is removing the surgical staples so the pooled blood can disperse, allowing the patient to breathe. In Tom's case, staff repeatedly tried and failed to insert a breathing tube through her mouth and into her airway, the inspection report shows. A last-ditch remedy would have been to punch a hole through the front of her throat to restore breathing, but the gastroenterologist later told an inspector that he, quote-unquote, wasn't prepared to do so. The inability to perform the suffocation rescue maneuver, the inspection report says, amounted to the center's, quote, failure to ensure patient safety, unquote. From the time a nurse called 911, it took 24 minutes to get Tom to the nearest hospital, EMS records show. She arrived without a pulse and remained on life support overnight as her children raced to her bedside to say goodbye. Tom's surgeon filed pleadings in court saying Tom's, quote, carelessness and negligence, unquote, caused her death. It's unclear what the defense meant by, and in italics here, negligence. The case reached a confidential settlement. After Tom's death, the center told Medicare inspectors that a qualified doctor would stay on site overnight after all upper spine cases. Nancy Epstein, MD, chief of neurosurgical and spine care at New York University Winthrop Hospital, said surgery centers doing delicate work near the spinal cord, windpipe, and esophagus in a same-day procedure is, quote-unquote, pretty revolting. But she said that the centers are making so much money, quote, reeling it in hand over fist, unquote, that the potential dangers are being ignored. Medically, it should not be tolerated, she said, but it is. And this editor's note, in July 2018, Medicare announced that it is reviewing its approval of 38 procedures at surgery centers. Next, from Reader's Digest, how to maintain your purpose in life. David G. Allen from CNN.com writes, you can start each year by writing it down anew. Your ever-changing answers may help you live longer and better. Every January for the past 20 years, I have taken a few moments to ponder the answer to the big question, what is the meaning of life? It's one of those enormous questions that is so important, philosophically and practically in terms of how we live our lives, and yet we never stop to really think about the answer. Given that you might be able to formulate your response in less than a minute, the wisdom-to-effort ratio for this philosophical exercise could not be more advantageous. I tend to ponder such things as the creator of the Wisdom Project, a collection of writings about the wisdom in everyday life experiences. Doing this simple exercise might even help you live longer. According to two separate studies published in the year 2014, one with 9,000 participants around age 65 and another with 6,000 people between 20 and 75, those who could articulate the meaning and purpose of their lives died later than those who saw their lives as aimless. It didn't seem to matter what meaning participants ascribed to their lives, whether it was personal, such as happiness, creative, such as making art, or altruistic, such as making the world a better place. It was having an answer to the question that mattered. The connection to longevity could be causal. That's, having purpose may help one cope with daily stress, as other research has shown. But it could also be that those who think about life's meaning are more likely to do other activities that promote good health. The reason I ask this question year after year is that my answer changes over time, which I find interesting and insightful. There is no objectively correct answer, I believe, only answers that are right for you at any given time. Great thinkers have given the question thought, so you can look to the words attributed to them for inspiration. Plato, the Greek philosopher who lived more than 2,300 years ago, concluded that only, quote, love can light that beacon which a man must steer by when he sets out to live the better life, unquote. Russian author Leo Tolstoy wrote, quote, the sole meaning of life is to serve humanity, unquote. Albert Einstein put it this way, quote, only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile, unquote. Martin Luther King Jr. framed the sentiment as a question, quote, life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others, unquote. And the Dalai Lama added, quote, if we find we cannot help others, the least we can do is desist from harming them, unquote. Others came to the same conclusion in their own words. For instance, Scottish rugby legend Nelson Henderson put the notion poetically when he said, quote, the true meaning of life is to plant trees under whose shade you do not expect to sit, unquote. And actor Whoopi Goldberg's meaning of life metaphor was to, quote, throw little torches out to lead people through the dark, unquote. My favorite answer, though, is the Zen-like circular reasoning attributed to writer Robert Byrne, who put it, quote, the purpose of life is a life of purpose, unquote. Some have concluded that life's meaning is subjective. Author Anais Nin wrote in her diary, quote, there is not one big cosmic meaning for all. There is only the meaning we each give to our life, an individual meaning, an individual plot, like an individual novel, a book for each person, unquote. I agree, which is why I recommend formulating your own answer. Taking a few moments to record your response to the question, what is the meaning of life, is the kind of simple exercise that effectively adds meaning to your life. And then I suggest answering it every year, looking back at how your thinking has evolved and even influenced by experience tells you something more about yourself. Cumulatively, it gets you closer to a deeper self-understanding. In the year 1997, my answer was, quote, the discovery, pursuit, and attainment of one's bliss, unquote, inspired by myth expert Joseph Campbell. A year later, it was to make, quote, the world a better place, unquote. In the year 2002, the year I got engaged, it was simply, quote, unquote, love. And the year we conceived our oldest daughter, it was the less romantic, quote, unquote, continuation of one's DNA to the next generation. But most years, my answer is some combination of love, legacy, happiness, experience, and helping others. If you do the annual quote-unquote meaning exercise, I suggest not looking at past answers before answering anew. I write them down on the same now yellowing piece of paper and keep it someplace safe. The last use of this experiment is to try to turn your answer into action. If you conclude, as Tolstoy and Einstein did, that the meaning of life is helping others, that should help motivate you to do more of it. If, quote-unquote, love is the answer, then love more. If it's, quote-unquote, find your bliss, then get searching for it. This is not a theoretical exercise. Whatever small step you take toward finding the meaning of life is a step toward a more meaningful and longer life. This sidebar here, readers share what brings meaning to their lives. From Atascocita, Texas, Kristen Lippincott writes, spreading warmth, helping those in need. I make blankets for children's hospitals, pet blankets for animal shelters, and shawls for the elderly. From Raleigh, North Carolina, here's Sriram Sridhar, collecting memories, not stuff. Stop buying trinkets that give you momentary pleasure. Rather, make memories that will last a lifetime. Travel and visit as many places as you can, reconnect and build friendships, and take plenty of photos along the way. Memories have given me much more long-lasting happiness than any physical object can bring. From Niverville, New York, Charlotte DiPiola writes, Building Legacy. I truly believe we can change the world one person at a time, which is why I became a literacy volunteer. Nothing is more memorable than the look in the eyes of an adult when he or she reads for the first time. You know, for as long as they live, they will remember you. From Columbus, Ohio, Mike Adam Koski reports this about heeding unexpected wisdom. Your question reminded me of the old Peanuts comic strip in which Lucy asks Charlie Brown, "Why do you think we're put here on Earth?" Charlie Brown says, "To make others happy." Lucy then asks, "What are the others put here for?" Cindy Simon from Wayne, New Jersey offers Empowering Others. Growing up with a disability, I was subject to discrimination and what is now called bullying. All I wanted was the equal opportunity to pursue my dreams. Empowering others to pursue theirs through teaching, advocacy, and the practice of law is what brings meaning to my life. Jenna Fulbrun of Goshen, Indiana, talks about playing as a team. My husband coaches high school tennis. In a preseason conditioning run, the lone freshman, new to the team, was falling behind. One of the older boys left his spot with the pack to go back and run with a new boy, encouraging him not to give up. To me, the meaning of life includes exactly this: eyes that see those falling behind and hearts motivated to do something about it. From Clarkston, Michigan, Annette Thomas offers Remembering All God's Creatures. Every day I try to do something for someone, whether human or animal. Take spiders outside into their natural habitat. Rescue stray dogs. Tell someone they are beautiful or worthy. Coax a turtle to water. Hold the hand of a dying person. Plant flowers and trees. Take care of the environment. Honor people of other cultures. Try to be caring. From Marie Bray of Southington, Connecticut, here's Cherishing Connections. First, we are someone's child, then a sibling, a friend, a spouse, a parent. Who we are to others defines us and gives us meaning in life. From Ron Justice of Baldwin, Missouri, here's Ending Up in the Right Place. It is simple. Life is a test to determine where you will spend eternity. From Riverton, Wyoming's Betty Stark's Case, Using Your Talent. Ask yourself, what do I most like to do? It's what you'll do best. I found my meaning when a cow moose ran through our yard. My husband snapped a picture, and I submitted it to the local newspaper with a caption. Can you do more? The publisher responded. For more than 30 years, I've written columns, feature stories, news items, and two books. At age 95, not a misprint, I'm still writing and using the gifts God gave me. Try using yours. You'll learn the true meaning of life. So will the lives you touch. From Christy Schmidt of Shingle Springs, California, Finding Joy in the Present. I have spent many years trying to figure this out. I went through life never thinking of the future or where my life might lead me. Now, I finally know what is important and the meaning of life. Remembering your blessings every day. Be nice. Take care of each other. Too bad it took 62 years to figure this out. And finally, from Hayward, California, here's Daniel Townsend with Being a Caring Partner. My wife and I were having the usual tense discussions about the fair division of labor at home. Then one day at church, the sermon was about the hidden value of service to others. I challenged myself to serve my wife every day for a month and see what happened. For a month, I never walked by something that could be done. I just picked it up, put it away, emptied the dishwasher, took out the trash. No thinking about whose turn it was or who made the mess. At the end of the month, I found that our life was happier, more contented, more intimate. I kept it up and won more than the lottery. We have been married 30 years and look forward to many more. Thank you for listening to today's Reader's Digest. If you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.